And we're back. If you're just joining us, we are Trend Radio, where we talk about what's hot and what's not. And Elise, we have a fabulous guest today.
Oh, a fabulous guest today. I'm going to introduce her.
Of course you are.
Yeah, I don't always, but I'm going to. Okay, we have sitting with us right now, Roseanne DeTorres. And she is from DeTorres and DeGeorge, 146 Main Street in Flemington. You can call them at 609-908-284-6005. And Roseanne is certified by the New Jersey Supreme Court as a matrimonial law attorney. She is amazing.
Roseanne,
hello.
Welcome to the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning.
Good
morning.
It's great to have you here. Roseanne, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved or got an interest in becoming an attorney?
Well, let's see. You know, I grew up in a big family, and really, I had to get out of there. Seven kids in the house, was number six out of seven, and I was always a little brainiac, loved to go to school, didn't want to work at the AMP. I grew up in, you know, Somerset County, New Jersey.
I didn't want to work there,
and so I had always had it in my mind that I was going to be a lawyer. You know, saw something on TV, I guess, and so that's what happened, and I just stuck with it, and it's been very, very good to me, better than I ever expected.
Terrific. Now, your firm is one of the top divorce firms in the state of New Jersey. What made you get interested in matrimonial?
We saw a real need and a niche there for us. To be perfectly honest, when I graduated from law school, I was practicing in Baltimore and the suburbs of Baltimore, and I moved back to New Jersey in 1994. And I went right out on my own. I had an opportunity to do that, and I had some office space, and I did that. And that's really what I saw as a niche. So I wanted to learn that type of business, and that's what people were asking me to do. People were asking me, you know, can you handle my divorce? Can you handle my divorce? And so I taught myself how to do family law and divorce. I started taking classes, continuing education classes. And then it just snowballed from there. And we became known as experts in that field, in that area.
It says that you're certified by the New Jersey Supreme Court as a matrimonial law attorney. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that designation allows me to put this little seal on my marketing materials, on my business card. And what it means is that the New Jersey Supreme Court has certified that I have the experience and knowledge of an expert in matrimonial law. In order to gain that designation, I had to take a test, a written exam. I also had to be recommended by judges that I appeared before. I also had to be recommended by other attorneys that I had cases against. So my adversaries had to recommend me. And
how interesting is that?
Yeah. So and you know, you do this for your colleagues. And like I said, I sat for the exam, I passed the exam, and then going forward, you have to take so many continuing education classes to maintain the designation, and you also have to retake the test every few years. So basically what it means to the consumer, the person out there, is that we're experts in this area of law. This is our niche. We don't do anything else. We don't do criminal defense. We don't do real estate. We don't do wills. We just do family law and divorce, and we are experts in this area.
Oh, wow. Well, you certainly are. That's wonderful. That's really so good to know anyway, though, because now people listening will know exactly where to go.
Exactly.
So you've never had a mentor to bring you into matrimonial. You did it on your own. You saw it was a niche. Do you have someone that you are mentoring, perhaps in the office, that you know, is looking for a direction, you know, to go?
I wouldn't say in the office, but my partner Erin DeGeorge came to me, I would say about 5 years ago. She was actually working for a mutual friend doing some per diem work, which means that she was just basically picking up some overflow. And I was so busy, I needed help. So I would pay her to do segments of cases for me. And I had been practicing on my own over 20 years by that time. And Erin DeGeorge was the first attorney that I worked that closely with that I honestly felt that I could make a partnership with her and make a successful team.
She's a doll. I love her.
She's not only an exceptional human being, but she's an amazing advocate and attorney. Very compassionate, well-prepared, super bright, personable. If you've ever seen her in action, if you need an attorney, you know, if I ever needed an attorney, Erin would be my attorney. She's amazing.
Now that's a huge compliment.
So, I mean, we mentor each other really, because there's always a situation that I am befuddled by, or I have a question in my mind. And that's one of the beautiful things about working with another professional of her caliber, is that there's somebody there to bounce ideas off of. And so we bring both of our talents to bear on problems that our clients bring. So from that standpoint, we feed off each other.
Now, she's matrimonial also?
Yep, that's all we do in our firm.
Okay, her too.
Exactly, yep.
You know, I almost want to get married so you guys can represent me for my divorce.
Because you know that if you got married, you'd get divorced.
Well, I don't know that for sure.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
She's going off the track record.
Oh, Steven. Okay, so can you tell us a little bit about, you know, when people get divorced, I often hear this when I'm sitting in my chair. I often hear about financial fairness. How does that work? How is that determined?
So it's not it's not a black and white answer. So the way we work is, if you call and say, I'm thinking about getting divorced, and you want to know what your economic responsibilities are, what you're entitled to, you would come in and we would do an in-depth interview of you. We would ask you 1,000 questions about what you have, what you owe, what your debts are. But we'd also talk to you about what your future goals and objectives are. What can you afford in the future? Do you have a job? Do you need to get a job? What is your future likely to look like? What would you hope it looks like? And then we start to put into place a strategy, a plan for you about how we're going to divide up your assets and the debts. In many cases, it's just split down the middle, but there are often situations where that 50-50 split doesn't work or it's not appropriate. For example, if you brought assets into the marriage, you'd want to retain those assets after divorce. There may be ways that we can help you to secure doing that. You may have contributed more economically to acquire assets during the divorce.
During the marriage.
Yeah. That's right. So there may be arguments we can make on your behalf to help you retain more of those assets after divorce. Divorce takes place in a court of equity. Equity just means what's fair. So it's not a 50-50 split automatically. There's no law that says it's a 50-50 split. There's a whole host of factors that we have to look at before we decide what is fair in this divorce. So everybody's situation is different. Everybody's situation will have a different result. And so that's how we go about trying to figure out what is fair in this particular situation.
I know this is not typical, but have you ever had the husband and the wife where you represent both? Just so we want the divorce, you know, we know your reputation. We know that you're fair. Help us out with this.
No, you can't do that.
Oh, you can't? That's a no-no?
No, that is a big, big no-no. So you cannot represent both parties in a divorce. You can only represent one party. It's a big conflict of interest to consult with the other side.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a big
and
no-no.
And that's what it becomes. It's the other side.
Well, I know realtors do it all the time.
Yeah.
No wow. comment.
The buyers and the sellers.
Wow. If you're just joining us now, you're listening to Trend Radio, and we are here with the fabulous Roseanne DeTorres from DeTorres and DeGeorge.
Attorneys at law.
Yes, they are.
Matrimonial. And child support. Is there anything set in stone as far as child support goes, or does that change also? Are there different factors involved there?
Yeah, so child support is based on a formula. So we have a mathematical formula on our computers at our offices. And once we know certain facts about a particular situation, we can calculate child support. But we need to know what those facts are, and there's quite a few of them. Obviously, we need to know who's going to be the parent of primary residence. That means the parent with whom the children spend most of their time, most of their overnights with. We need to know how many children there are. We need to know how many of those children are over the age of 12, because teenagers cost more. The child support guidelines are skewed higher for teenage children. We need to know what the parenting schedule is. How many overnights do the children spend with the other parent? we need to know what the party's incomes are. There's a lot of negotiation often happens around that issue of what do the parties earn, especially with self-employed individuals or people that get bonuses that are not recurring or consistent, right? So we may have a dispute about what their true incomes are. We also need to know if there's going to be a support obligation like alimony involved. We need to know that. We also need to know some other smaller factors like the health insurance premium for the children is part of the child support analysis. Daycare expenses can be part of the child support analysis. Once we know all those figures and facts, we throw all that data into our computer program and it provides a number, and that is the child support number. So it's kind of black and white, if you will, from that standpoint once you've arrived at all those assumptions.
So that's pretty fair.
That's fair.
Yeah. That computer program that you plug those numbers into, is that a certified, recognized program that attorneys use? Is it something that your firm developed? And do other attorneys use those same formulas? Is it a guideline?
It's called the New Jersey Child Support Guidelines, and they are presumptive, meaning the court has to follow them unless you have a good reason or can provide a basis for deviating from them. And that's not easy to do. So everybody uses them. I did not develop them. I wish I had. Maybe I wouldn't be sitting here chit-chatting with you all, but no, everybody has to use them. The court rules require them to be used, and the court has to follow those guidelines, the number that's provided by those guidelines, unless there's some compelling reason why we would deviate from them. Maybe a child with special needs that has extraordinary expenses, parties live far apart, and there's extraordinary travel expenses to have parenting time or some other compelling reason to deviate.
But that would go into the schedule, though.
It would be thrown into the analysis. Yeah. But those ancillary costs would be discretionary, and so you might negotiate what those are, and there may be a dispute about what that proper number would be in those circumstances. The guidelines don't apply, too, to kids that are in college, by the way. Once your children go off to college, they're not considered emancipated because they're still dependent upon you, but the child support guidelines don't apply to those children. That doesn't mean that there's no support obligation. It just means that there's a different analysis that applies for kids in school, in college, full-time college.
Now, would that mean paying for the college, paying for their books, that kind of thing?
Yeah. So what we would do with children in college is we'd look at what all the needs are, what the room, board, books, tuition, what their personal expenses would be. We come up with a budget for the child. And then we look at what financial aid might offset against those costs. And then the result, the difference is what the parents have to try to pay if they could afford to pay, always keeping in mind that there has to be an ability to pay, you know, that shortfall. There may be a corresponding child support figure paid to the custodial parent, even for a child in college, but it's not based on the guidelines, is my point.
You know, I have a question that we were talking about. We're talking about everything with child support, but typically, who actually gets custody of the kids? And that's an interesting thing also with all that.
Yeah, so that's a very important question to know the answer to before you calculate child support.
True.
You need to know that going in. The person that gets custody is the parent that provided the primary caretaking of the child or children during the marriage, and whether that was the mother or the father.
So it's not always the mother then?
It's not always the mother, no. But I think historically we see that still there is some gender-specific roles that still apply in our culture, in our environment, our society today. I mean, it's just the way it is. Mothers typically play that role, but it's not always the case. I have plenty of fathers that have represented that have primary physical custody of their children. And same-sex marriages.
I was just going to ask about that.
it gets back to who did the primary caretaking of the children during the relationship. And that includes things like, you know, getting up with the baby during, you know, in the middle of the night when the child wanted to be fed, to taking the children to school, taking the child to doctor appointments, taking the child to play dates, bathing, feeding, clothing, bedtime routines, and things like that. So you look at all of those things, and it may be that both parents did those things equally, in which case, then both parents should have, you know, significant and robust time with their children. That's what's best for the kids in those circumstances.
And that's really what I would think people would want. What's best for their children. Just because they can't live with each other doesn't mean they can't live with their kids.
I think most parents believe that they know what's best for their children. Unfortunately, though, many parents don't agree that the other parent knows what's best for their children. And that's where we come in.
So sometimes I guess you would need to have some mediation or something to help the parents so that they could help each other and help the kids, actually.
Yeah, so in cases where parents can't figure out how to resolve the parenting schedule or who's going to have the children most of the time, if we can't work that out through negotiation with the other attorneys in the case, then they go to mediation at the courthouse with a court mediator. It's very common and mandatory, in fact, in Hunterdon and Warren and Somerset counties. I'm not sure about Mercer. And if they can't, after that mediation session, still resolve their parenting disputes, the court will force the parties to engage in a best interest evaluation by a forensic psychologist that tests the parties, interviews the parties separately and with the children. They may even do a home study, a home visit. And then they issue a report, and that report then goes to the court, and it's pretty compelling. It's not binding on a judge, but it does carry some weight with a judge. And at that point, if you're still not able to resolve your situation, your parenting arrangement based on the expert's report, you're looking at a trial. Very, very uncommon, though. Most custody cases, 99% of the time, are resolved without a trial.
Have you had to go to trial often in your firm? Or are you able to work out the details?
Yeah, so in 25 years of practicing law, most of that time doing family law and divorce, I've only tried 4 or 5 cases from start to finish. So our track record is very, very good at resolving cases without the necessity of trial.
Oh, that's wonderful. That alleviates a lot of stress.
I would think the trial would really stretch out and, you know, the divorce.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest problems with trials is that not only do they cost exorbitant amounts of money to put on, but they delay the resolution of the divorce. In Hunterdon County right now, you won't get a trial for over a year, a trial date. And when you get a date, they're not consecutive dates. So you may start on one day and then the judge will tell you to come back next month for half a day or a day and then come back 2 months later for another day. And each time that you go back to that trial, you have to re-prepare because no lawyer can remember everything that was...
You lose the momentum.
You lose the momentum. It's most people simply cannot afford a trial. The cases that go to trial... Really, there's something else usually going on, some significant personality issue or just an inability of the parties to have a meeting of the minds in some way. They're just so polarized, but it's very, very uncommon. And in fact, we don't want to try cases. We they're time consuming and nobody's ever really happy at the end of that process.
Okay. Are there any cases that you, like, you know, you had these few cases in all these years, anything that you could share with us that, you know, really stood out in your mind?
Like the funny ones or the really interesting ones?
Well, if there was, well, whatever you want to bring.
If you're just joining us, we are Trend Radio, and we are talking with Roseanne DeTorres from DeTorres and DeGeorge Law Firm Matrimonial Law in Flemington, New Jersey.
So the cases, you know, the biggest case that I tried was with a pro se party on the other side, meaning they represented themselves.
Oh, boy.
And so that is often the most difficult case to resolve because... Without the benefit of having a lawyer on the other side, the person doesn't really know what they're entitled to, what their responsibilities are. They don't know what's a good resolution, what's a bad resolution. And so they become intimidated by the fact that their spouse has an attorney, and sometimes it becomes very difficult to communicate with that person because they don't really want to talk to me. Because
they're not a lawyer. They shouldn't be representing. That's like a bad thing to represent yourself.
Well, in this case, the person said that that was an economic decision they had to make. So they felt that they were forced to represent themselves for financial reasons. But the case could not be settled because every idea that I floated about how to resolve it was rejected. There was a lot of acrimony between these people. We tried that case over 14 days.
Oh, my.
And we had a very successful result. It went to an appeal. The other party appealed the decision. It's still under appeal years later.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, and it's not ending. It just never ended. So it's the sad... I hate to focus on that because that's a rare situation. It's so unlikely. And the parties lose everything. They gain nothing. And the process just sort of vanquishes them, both of them.
Well, isn't that wonderful, though, that you barely go to trial?
We hardly ever do.
That's wonderful.
Less than 1% of the time. We have the dubious distinction of trying, I think, the only... dog custody case in Hunterdon County, the Chihuahuas. We were able to win the custody of the Chihuahuas for our client, and we had a little reunification in our office when her ex-husband brought the dogs to our office after the trial, and we were able to reunify her with her pets, which, you know, in her case, they're just like her children.
Oh, absolutely. What was going on with that?
Yeah, there were three dogs involved, and for whatever reason, when the party separated, she only took one of them, and he had two of them.
So they must have missed each other.
And, you know, to her credit, she wanted those dogs. She knew those dogs belonged to her, and despite her modest means, she went to bat for those dogs. I give her a lot of credit.
Aww.
You know, she put her money where her mouth is because there was a cost associated with taking that to trial.
Well, good for her.
We settled every other issue in the divorce except for custody of the dogs.
Wow.
Wow, good for her that she won.
How did you prove that the dogs were hers?
So what we did was that's a very good question. We had a bill of sale from when they were purchased with her name on it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then throughout the marriage, she was able to produce vet records with her name on bills for the veterinary care for the animals with her name on it.
Right.
And so based on those facts, the judge gave her possession of the dogs.
Well, good for her.
That sounds so cut and dry that the judge had to make that determination.
Right. We presented those proofs to the spouse before trial, but again, it's an emotional thing, I think, for some people at that point. He just could not capitulate. I guess he figured that she would blink and she wouldn't want to spend the money to get custody of the animals.
But he must have loved the dogs, too. I mean,
I think...
He just didn't love her. And maybe he just...
He loved the dogs more than her.
So upset with her that
right.
he just wanted to take those dogs away from her.
I think, you know, in this particular situation, that's the truth of it, that he... This was his last hook to her and the last thing he could tweak her about. And so he pushed that as far as he could.
So it wasn't that he loved the dogs.
I don't know.
He just hated her.
He said he loved the dogs and cried over the dogs.
Well, she has them now and the dogs are all together. So that's a cool
thing. That's right. It's a happy ending.
Now, you said she was of modest means. Now, in a situation like that, how often does the opposite spouse have to pay for the others? Or does that ever happen?
It does happen sometimes. Our tradition in our legal system is that everybody, generally speaking, pays their own counsel fees. But there's always a big but. In a divorce situation, if you have one spouse that's the primary breadwinner, for example, and maybe a homemaker spouse, that homemaker spouse is going to have a good argument to have the other spouse pay for at least some of their counsel fees from their side of the assets that the other spouse gets in the divorce. Why? Because going forward into the future, that primary breadwinner is going to be in a far better position to replace those assets used to pay her counsel fees, in my example, and a far better opportunity to earn more money into the future. So because of the disparity in their financial positions, In that kind of a situation, you'll have one person pay at least some of the council fees. In other situations, everybody just takes their council fees out of the marital pot, whatever they need, and then they divide up the rest that's left over. If there's some wrongdoing and bad faith, which is not easy to prove, but you can, in some occasions, prove serious wrongdoing in a divorce context, then that party could be compelled to pay the other one's council fees.
So another question that I was wondering about, what happens when somebody doesn't pay child support or alimony, when they don't pay it?
If they don't pay child support or alimony and the support is being paid through probation, every person that receives support has the right to have those payments paid through the state of New Jersey's system, which is the probation department of your county. And the probation department acts as the collection agency, and they would schedule a hearing for nonpayment. And then the payer would have to come in and explain why they're not able to pay. And then the probation department may slap them on the wrist, give them a little more time. They may compel them to pay some of the what we call arrears, which is the past due amounts. They may set them up on a payment schedule to satisfy those past due amounts, or they'll take some other action. Eventually, if you continue to not pay and you're chronic about it, you can be incarcerated for that.
It's not automatic initially,
but after a few times of not paying, a warrant could be issued for your arrest. That's true, if you're paying through probation.
Now, what if you just don't have it and they put you in jail?
So if you don't have it because you're involuntarily unemployed, you lost your job and you haven't been able to secure a new job, then you have to prove that you've tried to find a new job, and they will give you some time and opportunity to do that. And you may be required to show that you've every week that you applied to 10 places for employment and prove that.
Okay.
Wow.
What if, I got a lot of what ifs here, one of the parties doesn't want the divorce and just says, no, I'm don't want a divorce. We could work this out. The other party says, no, I want the divorce.
We have a system of no-fault divorce in New Jersey. So even if you don't want to be divorced, you can't prevent a divorce from happening.
Okay.
Yeah, because the other person wants the divorce.
That's right.
The other person wants to get away.
Yeah, we call that irreconcilable differences.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a movie.
Wasn't
like
that a movie?
There was a movie like that years ago. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Wow, it was so nice being with you today. So nice and so informative.
Yeah, it was really great talking to you.
Thank you so much.
It was a lot of fun. And
thanks for having me. You've
given a lot of great information out there.
I appreciate
Definitely.
It.
Definitely. Give DeTorres and DeGeorge a call at 908-284-6005. And you can reach out to Roseanne at dndfamilylaw.com.
If you have a problem, give them a call. You'll be glad you did.
Definitely.
You've been listening to Trend Radio, where we talk about what's hot and what's not every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. Listen to us anytime, any place. Download the TuneIn Radio app to your smartphone or tablet. Make 920 The Voice your favorite.
And if you have a topic of interest that you want us to talk about, or you'd like to be a guest on our show, email us now, trendradio920@gmail.com. You'll be glad you did.
I'm Anthony Vincent.
And I'm Elise.
We'll talk to you next week.
Bye for now.